women's football was so successful that the mandarins who ran the football association took fright and decided to ban football league clubs from staging women's football. I think that the sports grounds, which aren't here anymore, should be celebrated not just because they were buildings, you know, or not just because some well-known sports people performed there, but because of their role in the community, in the society, the development, the DNA of so many families in Liverpool. We produced a world and Olympic gold medal winning skater, Jeanette Otway, from the Silver Blades. Can we do that today? Not a chance, because there's nowhere for anybody to go to learn how to skate. Somebody who, I would compare him with John Moores in the latter half of the 20th century, but hardly anybody's heard his name.
Welcome to the Richard Rudin podcast, and I'm with a guest we've had before on the podcast, in fact one of the first in this series. Last time we were in a rather noisy environment in a tapas restaurant in central Liverpool. Today we've come outside Liverpool to the wilds of Crosby, which I've not been to for a long time. But with me is Charlie Lambert, who has covered Merseyside sport since 1971, 54 years. And he's got a book coming out called... he's researching it at the moment as we record this, The Lost World of Merseyside Sport. Now, Merseyside is well known for its sport, of course, and particularly its two football teams, Liverpool FC and Liverpool Reserves. Get that in now. Just to get the controversy going from the start. But it has been known for a lot more than just football. So welcome, Charlie.
Hi, Richard. It's nice to be back on the podcast again.
We should, by the way, say where Crosby is for those outside the north and Londoners and overseas. So where are we in relation to Liverpool?
Well, we're just north of Liverpool. As you head out of Liverpool, heading north, you go out through Bootle, past the new Everton Stadium. I thought I might as well just get that in as well, in the interest of balance. Through Bootle and then up into Crosby. It's on the way heading north towards Formby and Southport.
So not far from the sea, basically.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so one of the things that struck me, first of all, was the number of greyhound tracks there used to be. I mean, greyhound seems to be an incredibly popular sport. Not one, not two, but three, but four greyhound stadiums, all meeting regularly and all making money.
Yes, that's right. It is incredible when you think back now. Liverpool did have four greyhound tracks. The first one opened in 1927 on Townsend Lane, a place called Breck Park. And then it was followed on by Stanley Stadium on Prescott Road. Then we had Seaforth Stadium and White City. White City is not far from Anfield Stadium on Lower Breck Road. And the reason why there were so many was because greyhound racing was an immensely profitable activity for the owners. Obviously, in the pre-television days, people would be looking around for entertainment. Football was once a week. Greyhound racing was every night at some of the stadiums, and sometimes twice a day, afternoon and then again in the evening. It was popular because it was easy for people to get to. It operated all year round. There was a chance to have a flutter and win some money. It was exciting because new technology was involved. The electric hare had been invented, which meant that you could have greyhounds chasing this artificial hare around the track. And the system of betting, the totalisator boards, which were quite dramatic in their own way, with all sorts of electric lights changing as the evening went on, was an attraction in itself. So the four started up. And after the Second World War, that was when the interest began to decline, and eventually the final track closed in the early 1960s.
So they were chasing an artificial hare, but of course this area is also known, one thing you didn't mention is the Waterloo Cup and hare coursing, very controversial. Why didn't you include that? Is it just too controversial? Or is it still there? That's the point.
There's no hare coursing these days, no.
Is there not?
No, oh, am I out of date? No, it's been gone for a while. I had to leave a lot out.
Yeah,
I had to leave a lot out. I just took a sample really for the purposes of the talk, but Olcar is where the hair coursing was held, and that went on for many years, and there was a theory that one of the reasons why Breck Park in Townsend Lane was one of the first greyhound tracks in the north of England to open was because it was so close to Olcar, and therefore there was a tradition and a culture of greyhounds being bred for the chase. So that was one factor. The hare coursing at Olcar, funnily enough, went on long after all the greyhound tracks had closed, but it's not with us anymore.
No. And the other thing that you touched, one of the many things you touched on, was women's football. Now, am I right in thinking, as I read this years ago, that women's football at one stage was more popular than the men's football for both Liverpool and Everton?
Yeah, well, there was a spell, and I think you're probably thinking about the war years in particular, when there was a very successful women's football team called Dick Kerr Ladies, which was based, I think I'm right in saying, in Preston, and they drew big crowds, including a massive crowd at Goodison Park for one game, which I think was during the Second World War. I don't have all those facts to my fingertips right now, but women's football was so successful that the Mandarins, who ran the Football Association, took fright and decided to ban football league clubs from staging women's football. So we had women with organised teams, coaching and all the rest of it, but nowhere to play. Nowhere that's going to bring in a decent crowd anyway. So that is, that's a story which has unravelled over time. And fortunately, we now have the exact opposite of that, where Everton's current stadium at Goodison Park is going to be for women exclusively as from next season.
And boxing, we've got to mention that. Hugely important sport and a very well-known stadium right in the centre of Liverpool.
Yeah, the stadium in Bixter Street.
Just the stadium.
Called just the stadium, and yeah. Everybody knew what stadium we were talking about. Funnily enough, before that, there was a precursor to the Bixter Street stadium, which is also called the stadium, and that was just next door to Lime Street Station in a place called Pudsey Street. Pudsey Street is still there. That stadium has been long gone. It was demolished in the 1930s. But again, a bit like the greyhounds, boxing was a very popular and profitable sport because it didn't take a huge amount of money to run, and it had a ready uptake in terms of an audience being close by in a city centre before people were moved out to Skem and Runcorn and all that. It was easy for people to get to. The stadium, the one in Bixter Street, opened in the 1930s. So just like with the greyhounds, no television at home, films, few and far between. People are looking for things to do that's not going to cost a huge amount of money, and boxing was an attractive proposition, especially as Liverpool began to produce champions.
Well, I was going to say, because it wasn't just local interest. I mean, the World Championships light heavyweight championship with John Conte was held in Liverpool.
Yeah, Conte defended his light heavyweight championship, I think, three times, having won it in America. And there were many other successful world and European title events held at the stadium. People like Alan Rudkin, for example, who became a world champion. And also, something that I didn't mention during the talk, was the very, very successful amateur tradition of boxing in Liverpool as well, where the amateurs were there a lot, and a lot of really top-class Liverpool boxers who never turned pro had fantastic careers at the stadium.
And boxing's a very big thing now. As you know, I'm involved with this Come Together Hub, and boxing is, and have their own championships and so forth, is very big in terms of trying to divert young men off getting into trouble off the street. So it's seen as a very important sport. Now, the police helped to fund some of the boxing clubs, I believe.
Yeah, and I think it always was that way, that boxing for a long time has been seen as something which is to be celebrated, not just at world championship level, but also at grassroots level. Young lads and girls as well get a fantastic grounding in terms of discipline, learning respect, honing their own fitness, and being confident in themselves as well, knowing how to conduct themselves. And this is not a recent thing. This has been going on for time immemorial, really. Trainers who operate their own gyms have become legendary in the way that they have contributed to keeping youngsters from going astray.
And time and again, you come back to this point, as you mentioned in this interview, about the memories that people have and the family occasions. It wasn't just all men going to something, but families would go. People went through multi-generation visits. Just a hugely important part of predominantly working class life, let's be honest, in Liverpool, where the majority of the people are working class, of course.
Yes, I think that the sports grounds, which aren't here anymore, should be celebrated, not just because they were buildings, or not just because some well-known sports people performed there, but because of their role in the community, in the society, the development, the DNA of so many families in Liverpool. People remember going to the boxing with their granddad or going to watch a football match with their cousins and all that kind of thing. It means more. It means more than just going to the shops or going to the pub or something like that, because of the atmosphere when you're there and the excitement that it generates, the triumph and the disaster and learning to live with both of them and all the rest of it.
And the stadium, just going back, was used for political meetings. You say Winston Churchill spoke there, big union rallies, evangelicals.
Yeah.
So quite a wide spectrum of interest was served by the stadium there.
Yes. A couple of weeks ago, I went to the pub that was the local for the stadium, the Cross Keys. And it's fantastic. They've got a load of old historical photos all around the wall about events at the stadium. And there was one house looking at it. And all these men were all around the ring. There was somebody in the middle of the ring. No sign of any boxers. Everybody seemed to be looking at the camera. So obviously very well staged. And I could just make out a caption underneath, which was something to do with Parson somebody, and I forget the name now, takes to the ring. And I looked up the person's name, and it turned out that he was an evangelical minister who had come to Liverpool to inspire the masses in the cause of Christianity, and obviously had a massive turnout. And just to see that photograph in a pub today in Liverpool in 2025 underlines the contribution that these places made. And one of the other venues that I mentioned in the talk, Richard, was the Silver Blades Ice Rink. And I mentioned how it cost a lot of money to keep going, and when the owner, Les Williams, in the 1980s was struggling to keep it going, he got a grant from the Sports Council, £75,000, which was great. Liverpool City Council promised a grant of £25,000, but then they reneged and said it would have to be repaid, it was only going to be a loan. As a result of that, Les couldn't keep it going, and so the Silver Blades Ice Rink closed. And what I think is that the City Council should have been more aware of this place's importance to the community. It wasn't just somewhere where people went to have a skate. It was...
And meet up with a date and...
Yeah, well, it was all that as well, because DJs there and dancers and everything. But that sums up what a fantastic contribution that it made to the society at that time and still would do today. We produced an Olympic gold medal winning skater, Jeanette Oldtwig, from the Silver Blades. Can we do that today? Not a chance, because there's nowhere for anybody to go to learn how to skate.
And rugby league, well, I mean, Liverpool surrounded by big rugby league towns, St Helens and Wigan, obviously, but it was quite big in Liverpool back in the day too.
Well, it wanted to be big. There was a rugby league team for two or three decades in Liverpool, playing at two or three different venues as well. But it never really got off the ground because there just wasn't a demand from the public. And it probably would have ceased much earlier than it actually did had the Rugby Football League itself, the governing body, not been very, very keen to see the game in Liverpool. So they were subsidising the team.
Why do you think it never took off in Liverpool? I mean, it's so close to Wigan and St Helens, and it seems a completely different culture here.
It is. I think, Wigan, St Helens, Widnes, they've all got their own teams already. They didn't need to come to Liverpool. Liverpool had Liverpool and Everton. It's very much an association football city. And there wasn't the grassroots. Very few young people from Liverpool wanted to come and train and try to become a big rugby league star. The vast majority of players were imports from outside the patch. The kids all wanted to be football players.
And you mentioned a big name that nobody's heard of anymore, but you said was as important in his day in the first part of the 20th century as John Moores was in the second part.
Yeah, and this is a man called John Bilsland, who was a Scotsman by birth. He became a very influential sports entrepreneur in Liverpool, electrical engineer by training and experience. But he, at different times, he owned three of Liverpool's four Greyhound tracks, as well as being the person who was behind the promotion of top-class boxing at those Greyhound tracks, promoting Speedway, and also subsidising the rugby league team, and then leaving a very considerable bequest to Liverpool University when he passed away in 1950, worth over £1 million these days. Somebody who, I would compare him with John Moores in the latter half of the 20th century, but hardly anybody's heard his name. So let's hear his name, John Bilsland. Thank you for your contribution.
And we should mention Speedway, of course, mustn't miss that out, and dirt track racing, as you described it, is even more brutal than Speedway. And that's something that I associate with the Midlands. I know we covered it a lot in Midlands radio. Speedway was very, very big in the 70s and 80s, but I hadn't realised it was so big on Merseyside.
Yeah, I mean, and it was for the time, you know, with a track at Seaforth and also the one at Stanley off Prescott Road. And of course, the great thing about that Speedway was the emergence of Peter Craven, a lad from Liverpool, went along with his brother, became a top-class Speedway star because there was a Speedway track on his doorstep. After a couple of years starring with Liverpool, he was signed by Bellevue Aces in Manchester, who are one of the top teams, still are, and Peter went on to become British champion twice and world championship twice. World champion twice.
Wow.
You know, and this kid from Liverpool, learning his trade, crafting his trade at Stanley Track. Again, another opportunity which kids these days are not going to have because the facility just isn't there.
What's your favourite stadium, do you think, that's now gone? What's the one that's most powerful in its nostalgic appeal and its memories of countless generations or several generations, certainly of Merseysiders?
I would say probably Silver Blades. Mm. It's a place where at least I knew it because it was still around until the 1980s, and I was able to go there and have a skate, take the kids. I never went there on a regular basis, but I think it's a place which contributed so much to sporting history in Liverpool and worldwide when you consider some of the champions, not just Jeanette Aldwick, but other champions who brought world titles back to the place. And it's a crying shame that we don't have a skating rink these days.
Just on the matter of process of researching your book, finally, a lot of photographs, of course, you've got newspaper cuttings. What's been your greatest source of archive material and what's been your greatest frustration that you haven't been able to find any archive?
The greatest frustration is I've not been able to find a photograph of John Bilsland, the man, the benefactor that we just mentioned. I've searched high and low. No joy yet. The online British newspaper archive is a good resource. But I'm also having a wonderful time finding what resources are available in pubs. Pubs are great for keeping photographs of their own locality. And I'll tell you one story in particular regarding the old boxing stadium by Lime Street Station in Liverpool on Pudsey Street. I've got a book at home published by English Heritage, which talks about some of these old stadiums in Liverpool. It talks about Pudsey Street. It's got a couple of pictures of the inside, but it says no photographs of the exterior have survived. Okay. I went to a pub called Mar Edgerton's, which is actually on Pudsey Street, and that pub was there when the stadium was there. It was called the Eagle in those days. And I thought they might have some photos on the wall of the, you know, of the boxes and etc. They got loads of photos of showbiz stars because it's so close to the Empire Theatre. All big stars, including Laurel and Hardy, fantastic. Anyway, I went and sat down to have a pint and something to eat at a section of the pub where there were photos on the wall, but they weren't the big showbiz stars. And what should be behind me when I look round but an aerial photograph of that section of London Road, and I could clearly see the arched roof of the old stadium and the sign saying stadium on top of it. A shot of the exterior of the stadium, which English Heritage say doesn't exist. Well, we know better, don't we?
Well, good luck with the book. Any idea of publication date?
I haven't got a clue. It's going to take me at least a year to finish writing it, and I've not spoken to any publishers yet because I need to get a bit further down the line. Whether it'll come out in some format, whether it's an audio book or a series of podcasts or a proper, I'd like it to be a proper book. But
it needs to be a coffee table book.
We'll see.
For those memories, and I presume it's like everything. You start researching one thing, it leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. Before you know, the whole thing is just mushroomed, and then you've got to do the editing.
Yes, absolutely. But do you know what? I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I thoroughly enjoying the research, finding things out that I didn't know. Some of the contacts I've made with people, and the interest that everybody has. As soon as I mention what I'm doing, people are so interested, which is really great.
Charlie, pleasure as ever. Well, thanks very much, Charlie. That's the Richard Rudin podcast from Crosby. And next time, who knows, in the world of the Rudin podcasts, who we should be talking to and where we'll be going with it. But thanks for listening this time. And, of course, when the book is published, The Lost World of Merseyside Sport, you will be the first to hear about it on the Richard Rudin podcast.